watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Dwindling supplies of fossil fuels, an economy based on ever-increasing energy consumption and growth, an overpopulated planet, eroded soil, polluted air and water, and increasing climate instability are converging upon us and will lead to vast changes within our lifetimes. The question we face is whether we will swim with the tide or be swept away. Kinsale, a town of 7,000 in West County Cork, Ireland, has decided to take decisive action. They have developed an extensive plan for transition to a post-petroleum sustainable society. Last June, they hosted a conference titled Fueling the Future: The Challenge and Opportunity of Peak Oil, which brought together scientists, economists, ecologists, and others to develop understanding of the problems and to envision solutions. We'll begin the program this week by playing you two of the presentations from that conference. Our first speaker will be Dr. Colin Campbell, a petroleum geologist who has been at the forefront of raising awareness of peak oil and who founded the Association for the Study of Peak Oil 6 years ago.
Today I'm going to talk about the end of the first half of the age of oil. The talk has five parts, really. I'm going to start with what I call geological reality. And I do wish to stress that producing oil relies on finding the stuff, and that is absolutely a geological matter. It's not a matter of investment. It's not a matter of technology or politics. All of those things are involved, but it really depends on geology. So I'll give you a little course on geology just to emphasize that point. Then move on to look at the pattern of depletion. Obviously, discovery starts in any place and it ends sometime because it's a finite amount. And we have this classic curve starting and ending and reaching a peak in between. And this is really very obvious to anyone who thinks about it. So I'll go on and talk a little bit about the confusion, why this is not better understood, and then say a little bit about the consequence and suggest some of the solutions. So to start then with this very short course of petroleum geology, I do think it's important that some idea of this situation everyone should have. Well, the bulk of the world's oil was formed at just two brief moments of extreme global warming, 90 and 150 million years ago. And at these times, the continents were moving apart and rifts developed between them. And these warm, sunlit waters provided a magnificent place for algae to proliferate. So there was just a proliferation of these algae that took the oxygen out of the water and more or less poisoned the seas and lakes. And the organic material from this situation, which was rare and exceptional, the organic material fell to the bottom of these rifts and was later buried. So then we move on a little bit and imagine that the continents, mountains rose in the continents and the rocks were eroded and sands and shales got swept by rivers and filled up these rifts. And they were later covered by younger sediments. And then earth movements happened that folded the rocks, into folds and faults and so on. So this pictures, once this organic stuff was buried to about 2,000 meters depth, it was cooked enough, heated enough for chemical reactions to turn it into oil. And once formed, it was under enormous pressure down there, and it began to move upwards, as this shows. Now, some of it dissipated, was just lost in the rocks. Some of it seeped out and escaped even to the surface. But just locally, in very rare combination of circumstances, it did collect in a geological trap. That's called an anticline, this arch-like fold. So the point of all of this is it's extremely rare combination of circumstances that give you an oil field. Anyway, so this tells us where you can look for oil, and it also tells you where you won't find it. Now, I'd always like to include a little bit of credentials as to why I should talk to you at all. And this picture was taken in the 60s when I was a field geologist back in Colombia, in the interior of Colombia, and I just say a few little words about what I was doing. On the scarp in the background there, that scarp was a beautiful sandstone, about 100 meters of porous white sandstone. And this looked to me like a reservoir, a beautiful reservoir. The oil could accumulate in the spaces between the grains. And just close to where these horses are, we found black shales. When you hit them with a hammer and smelt them, they smelled of oil. So we had two of the ingredients we wanted. We had a reservoir and we had a source. But in the mountains, the rocks were too deformed, too broken up to be satisfactory traps for oil. But just in front of the mountains, there was a fold belt and then plains, and it didn't take any enormous stretch of imagination to say that in this zone we would have just the precise combination of circumstances that we looked for. But the problem was that this area was right in the interior of South America, three ranges of Andes from the coast, and the economists didn't like this place. They said, can't you find oil on the coast? It would be so much more profitable to export it from the coast. And I said, well, yes, it's a fantastic idea. There's only one flaw, is the rocks just don't have oil by the coast, you know. And anyway, for a long time, they looked along the coast because that made economic sense. And 25 years after this picture was taken, one oil company did pluck up courage to go to the right place, and it found a giant oil field. Itself then later followed by a whole string down in front of the Andes, the largest new onshore province found in the Western Hemisphere since then. So my point really is that finding oil isn't all that difficult if you look in the right place. And even simple people on a mule can get much of the good ideas, you know. So let's move on. So depletion is easy to grasp. I suppose the beer drinkers amongst you here will know that the glass starts full and it ends empty, and that the quicker you drink it, the quicker it's gone. Is that right? And the same principle applies to oil and gas. I mean, this is so obvious because, as I stress, it was formed in the geological past. There's only a finite amount there. And the bar stops at midnight, by the way. So how has this very obvious reality been concealed? I mean, it seems so obvious, and yet as we come to think about it, it's really a rather devastating realization. This comes as a shock when we wake up to this situation, in a way. So, as I say, it was formed in the geological past. There's only a certain amount there. We can't grow more of it. And a lot of people say, are we running out of oil? This is a common question that people ask. And the answer, the simple, straight answer is yes, of course we're running out. And we started doing that when we produced the first barrel. But the last barrel doesn't come till far in the future and is really not the issue. The difference between one barrel and zero is irrelevant at that future moment in history. The real important point comes when production begins to decline. That's the issue that faces it. That is the turning point, the discontinuity. And that normally comes, you can look at it in 100 different countries, it normally comes when more or less half the total has been produced. So it rises to a peak and it declines. So all of this would be entirely self-evident. This is not rocket science, what I'm talking about. This is so obvious, so evident, if we had valid data in the public domain. And the main problem in addressing this whole subject is that the public data is so grossly unreliable. It's extraordinary, really, that such a critical subject should be so confused. And I think that the governments have been really seriously misled by what I call the malign influence of economists, because under the mentality and mindset and experience of economists, they simply say, well, supply must always meet demand in an open market. Their reaction, the European Union, for example, facing security of supply issues, its reaction is liberalize the markets. They don't realize the supreme irony that the more efficient you are at producing this stuff, the quicker it is gone. So you have this mindset of the economists. They say that substitutes naturally arise as the, when needed. And then I think we move from that sort of mindset that influences the politicians to the official institutions such as the International Energy Agency, who really are under political pressures to deliver a comforting message, and they can't quite bring themselves to come out and say it the way it is. So in reality, we need the skills of a detective, you could say, to smoke around and smell out the information. You can get it, but it's not very easy and it's not very obvious. It's a kind of detective work to try and find the true numbers. So why do we need to know? As has already been stressed, oil and gas dominate our lives. You know, 40% of traded energy is oil. More than 90% of transport fuel is made from oil. Trade depends on transport. And much electricity is made from gas, and I'll come back and talk about that in relation to Ireland. And then don't forget that oil is critical for agriculture, fuels the tractor, transports the produce to the cities, and above all gives synthetic nutrients and pesticides, which is essential to modern crops, you could say. So, and people eat, therefore this input of oil energy and oil materials is really critical to survival in a sense. So let's go back a little bit to this confused information. Why weren't we told the truth about all of this? And it's a very complicated thing, and I'll try and simplify it as much as I can, but in principle, the oil companies, the big international oil companies, were subject to very strict stock exchange rules developed early in the industry, primarily in America. And these rules were designed to prevent fraudulent exaggeration. That's what the stock market was trying to prevent. They had no particular problem if you claimed less than you'd found. So, in practice, the oil companies reported much less than they actually found. So they'd report 10 this year. Next year they could revise it upward to 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. So this gave this comforting, happy picture of growth, which made eminent good sense from a commercial standpoint. It delivered a nice message to the stock market of steady, well-managed growth. And this is one of the prime reasons why this is confused, because by underreporting to begin with, the reserves were revised upwards all the time, which people thought meant more stuff was being found, better technology, all those explanations. It was simply in the reporting. So that's one of the prime reasons. And I don't say that everybody likes to accuse the oil companies of trickery and conspiracy and all of that. I don't think it really was. It was just pragmatic management in days before this was really a sensitive issue at all. And then OPEC, for its point, exaggerated. I'll come to that in a second. But I do think, just in the last few months even, we find a change in the position of the oil companies. And I think ExxonMobil, the large American oil company, really is most forthright in putting the true position. They've published true discovery record using the right industry data with all of these revisions backdated to their discovery, which I'll show you in a minute. Chevron Texaco speaks of inflection. It can't quite say the word peak, but it's getting close. Shell now. Shell, you see, most of the other companies managed to evade this situation by merging. So if they merged to ExxonMobil, Chevron, Texaco, well, it obscured the accounts enough that the combined thing still looked good enough. Well, Shell, which has a kind of superior mentality, Shell, at least in their own eyes, is better than anyone else, so they didn't merge. Why would they soil their hands merging with anybody else? So Shell used up its unreported reserves quicker because it simply wasn't finding it in the ground and didn't conceal it by these mergers. Now, going to the OPEC countries, this is kind of a complicated but rather vital part of the story. In 1980, Kuwait reported reserves of 65 billion barrels. Next year, 66, then down to 65, 64, 64, and then suddenly, in 1985, when prices were low, it added 50% to its report, bringing it to 90. Nothing had changed in the oil fields. Nothing had been found. Nothing had happened. This was simply in the reporting. And as we look back now, we find that Kuwait had produced up to that date about 23. So 23 and 64 is 87, which is almost the 90 number they reported. So with a little flexibility, I think, and this isn't 100% sure, but I think they started reporting the total they had found, not what has left. And as you know, the OPEC countries had this agreement amongst themselves that limited production of each of them, and it was based on reserves. So the more you reported, the more you could produce, the more money you would make. Anyway, the other countries didn't know quite how to react to this move by Kuwait for a while. And then a couple of years later, Kuwait added another 92. This just proved too much for the others. They couldn't stand this, what amounted to cheating. And so what did they do? We found Abu Dhabi there. It said, okay, if you're 92, so are we. So they increased from 31 to 92. Iran, well, it said, we are clearly bigger than this Abu Dhabi place. Let's call it 93, up from 49. And then Iraq, Saddam said, well, not to be outdone, I'll give them a rounded 100. So these three countries simply matched Kuwait. There's no substance to this number whatsoever. Then we look at the what could Saudi Arabia do? It didn't know how to react to this situation, so it dithered for another couple of years. And it couldn't match Kuwait because it was already reporting more. So it didn't know quite what to do. But 2 years later, it followed the same practice as Kuwait of announcing the total it had found, not what was left, increasing from 170 to 258. And it's interesting that there's this little place called the Neutral Zone that is owned both by Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. Well, it announced no such increase because it had two owners who had no common motive to do so. And as you look at the numbers subsequently, is it remotely plausible that Abu Dhabi has been 92 for all these years since, despite production? So these numbers appear religiously in all the public databases without comment, but you can see that they're just fraudulent. So you have to take out something like 300 billion barrels to compensate for this extreme distortion arising from OPEC. So if we unscramble all this as well as we can, we see the reported reserves shown in red here. And if this is all you looked at, you would be forgiven for seeing them rising gradually. And you would say, well, there's no problem. We keep finding more. Technology is going forward. Investment is being made. And that is the viewpoint of the economist. And you can see this sudden surge around the late 80s, which was the OPEC issue I've just described. But then if you take the right industry numbers, as now published by Mobil, and you attribute all the oil from an oil field to the date on which it was discovered, you have the black line, and we see that discovery has been in relentless decline since 1964, and this curve is flattening, and one can easily extrapolate it out to show what is left. So you have this fundamental difference between the public opinion in red and the reality in black. So I'll just now move on to to show you a few examples. Won't spend any time on it, but just like to show you this relationship between discovery, which is going to be shown in green bars, and production in red. So the United States, this is the most mature place of all. Peak discovery was in the 1930s with the East Texas field, and peak production was 40 years later in 1970. And this is quite of a long time, and don't forget, technology was rather primitive in those days. Things went slower. Also, in the particular environment of the United States, there was a very large number of small companies. So this was a rather long time lag. But now the United States has been in relentless decline for getting on for 40 years, and there is no hope whatever that this trend is going to change direction. You look at Egypt, no particular reason to show you Egypt, but it's the same classic pattern. The green bars are discovery, the big fields come in first, they've been falling in size. That has given a corresponding peak of production. Production's now falling at about 6% a year. And this is a fairly devastating story for a populous country like Egypt. There's 70 million people living there, and quite soon they're going to be running out of their essential fuels. Indonesia, it's an interesting case. You had an early onshore phase of exploration with a peak in the 40s. They then moved offshore, and you see these two trends faithfully reflected in the production after a time lag. Then Russia. That's interesting too, because we still see, despite the operations under the communist system, completely different economic environment, we find the same natural pattern of discovery, big fields coming in first and fading out. And this saddle in the production was simply as a result of the fall of the communists and the confusion, and it's now building slowly to a second peak before final decline sets in. And it's not growing very fast because the Russian government has woken up to this whole story and is having new policies aimed to try to conserve what the Russians have for as long as possible, going back to a kind of centralist approach. China, just about at the top now. And the United Kingdom's quite interesting here again, the same classic pattern. The discovery peak was in the 70s when the giant fields of the North Sea came in, and this little saddle was the accident on one of the fields that shut down production for a while. And now Britain is way over peak, peaked in 1999, production's falling about 6% a year. So if we put all of that together, we get this pattern, as I say, published by ExxonMobil to their enormous credit, and we see that discovery has been in relentless decline for 40 years. Okay, so it's been falling despite a worldwide search, always aimed at the biggest and best prospects. No one's out there looking for the worst and smallest. It's despite all the enormous advances in technology. Seismic surveys today has a scanning. You can see the smallest detail. And despite a very happy economic environment whereby most of the cost of exploration is written off against tax. So I suggest that this downward trend is imposed by nature and has nothing much to do with any human endeavor. And it takes no feat of imagination to extrapolate it on in green here to show what is left to find in the future. That even may be a bit optimistic. And then in black here, I have production superimposed, and we see that the world started using more than it found in 1981, and the gap is widening. Take a good look at this one, because really it says it all. This widening gap is what we are really here to consider. It just can't go on, you know. So if we piece it all together, we have this pattern. The green is the... there are lots of different categories of oil that confuse the story further, but the green is the regular, easy, cheap stuff that has contributed most to date and will dominate all supply far into the future. Then we hear a lot about these heavy oils of Canada, the tar sands of Canada and Venezuela. This is the resource is enormous. There's a lot of oil there, but digging it up, got to remove 75 meters of overburden with shovels the size of this tent here, and centrifuge it and heat it and cook it and process it. So it's a slow, difficult, expensive, and environmentally damaging activity. We can see that production will grow in the future, but it won't have much impact on peak, although it ameliorates the decline. Then the last frontier of all is the ultra-deep water, the deep water, more than 500 meters of water. The fact that the industry is now looking in this deep water under these extreme technical problems tells you there isn't anywhere else easier left. And as we now know more about the deep water domain, we can say that it is also geologically limited. There are just a few places where the continents moved apart that has this very special combination of geology to work. Then there's a possibility of a little more polar. The polar regions are rather unexplored. Not surprisingly, under 8 feet of ice, it's not easy to run seismic surveys. So, but we could say perhaps a little more comes in from the Siberian offshore. Don't rely on it. Then I show gas. That depletes rather differently, and I think we haven't time to talk about that particularly. Gas liquids. And finally, at the top, some non-conventional gases such as coal bed methane and things like that. So that sums up that part of the story, and I now move on a bit from the technical side of things and maybe say a few words about the age of oil. And I think the important point is we're all used to cycles like this. The stock market lives on cycles, but the oil age is a single cycle, and it's lasted 150 years. Since the first wells were drilled in Pennsylvania and on the shores of the Caspian. And this remarkable, and a very remarkable chapter in history, has stimulated industry, transport and trade, agriculture, which allowed the population of the world to rise sixfold exactly in parallel with oil. And in addition to all those things, it saw the enormous expansion of financial capital. And this is a strange subject that I'll say a little word about in a minute, and which I don't really understand, I have to say. But I think we could devise from this a kind of formula, GE equals GE, that is to say, growing energy equals a growing economy. So this financial capital stuff is very hard for mortals to understand, but as I understand it to the degree I do, it seems that the banks over the last 100 years or so were lending money in excess of what they had on deposit, in effect creating money out of thin air. But, and you wouldn't think such a system would work, but it did work because the resulting expansion, tomorrow's expansion, effectively was collateral for today's debt. And most people think, well, it's money that makes the whole world run. But in reality, it is the underlying cheap energy supply, much from oil, that makes everything happen. So this poses an enormous problem for the financial stability of the world in the future as the essential energy begins to go down. And then another aspect I won't particularly stress, but it seems that the primary benefit of empire, previously the British Empire, was not really a military thing, but it was the hidden flow of rent, you could say, that flows back to the issuers of a global currency. And of course, it was previously the pound sterling who had this sort of hidden flow to the City of London by control of the world's trading currency. And now it's the United States, of course. And it seems that the physical imports of oil into the United States over the last, I don't know, 20 years or so, has been exactly matched by the expansion of domestic credit. So, in reality, they didn't really pay for it at all. It was just created out of debt, and this debt demanded expansion to justify it. So, we must now put into question whether this expansion is any longer possible as the underlying energy supply begins to decline.
That was Dr. Colin Campbell, a petroleum geologist, founder of the ASPO, speaking last June in Kinsale, Ireland. Our next speaker from that same conference is well known to longtime listeners of this program. He is Richard Heinberg of New College of California, author of Power Down and The Party's Over.
Well, it's a great honor for me to follow Colin Campbell on the stage here. His work has been a tremendous inspiration to me. I think it's fair to say I would not be here today if it weren't for his work. My work is actually as a teacher of human ecology and a writer and journalist. So it's in that role that I'm going to try to set a little bit of context here for us all to understand peak oil in terms of its historic significance. First of all, human societies are like ecosystems and organisms in that all are energy-transforming systems. Without energy, they don't function. And human societies, again, like ecosystems and organisms, can only grow in scale and complexity as they grow in terms of energy flows. So if you want to understand human history, you really have to understand energy. We've been using energy since the very beginning, but for tens of thousands of years, until very recent time, it's been using energy on a yearly solar input basis. That is what has changed over the last 150 years. Now, as a human ecologist, what drew my attention to the subject of oil was actually a concern about understanding the Industrial Revolution. Clearly, with the Industrial Revolution, something unprecedented had happened in human history. Our population took this familiar J-curve form. Now, we ecologists study population and resources, and when we see a J-curve like this in population, we call that a population bloom. And in every instance, a population bloom is due to a sudden availability of a food resource, which is actually an energy resource. An example that comes quickly to mind to folks where I live in Northern California, which is wine country, is the addition of yeast to a 10% sugar solution, the making of wine. We add the yeast to the grape juice. The yeast proliferate. They consume the resource, they consume the sugar and the grape juice, and then they also excrete alcohol, which then poisons the yeast. The yeast die, but in the process, of course, they produce a lot of alcohol, which is the point of the whole exercise as far as we're concerned. Now, this brings up an important question. Are we essentially doing the same thing as the yeast, growing our population to take advantage of a suddenly available but finite supply of energy resource, which has become, in effect, a food resource because of the way that we have used energy to increase our food production and also to increase the availability of food and other necessary resources through increasing scale and speed of transportation? Well, the fossil-fueled industrial era has been like winning the energy lottery. If before we were relying on yearly solar input, it's as though with the discovery of oil we had discovered a treasure chest in the backyard. It was entirely understandable that we human beings would take that treasure and spend it, make use of it. It's all played out over a very short historical period from 1859, when the first commercial oil well was drilled in Pennsylvania, all the way to today. This is a picture of Ghawar in Saudi Arabia, the world's largest oil field that produces something like 5 million barrels of oil per day. Just 150 years. And during that time, our way of life has transformed itself, not just the population, but also the per capita consumption of resources and how we've used those resources and our expectations of life. This is a graph of work done in the U.S. economy, which isn't that much different from any other industrialized nation. In 1850, about 65% of the work being done was being done by muscle power, by animal muscle power, actually. And another 16 or 18% was being done by human muscle power. And, of course, in the U.S., that was to a large extent, the muscles of kidnapped Africans. Only about 16 or 18% of the work being done was by fuel-fed machinery. Now, by 1960, toward the end of this graph, the situation has changed entirely. Almost all of the work being done in the U.S. economy is being done by fuel-fed machinery. Why? Why this transition? Because of the enormously cheap energy available from fossil fuels. A person working hard for an hour can generate about 625 BTUs of energy, British thermal units of energy. A single gallon of gasoline, 4 liters of petrol, which we in the U.S. pay $2.50 for, contains about 125,000 BTUs of energy. So that's the energy equivalent of over a month's human labor. So if we were to equate the two, either we'd be paying people 1/2 cent per hour for their work, or we'd be paying over $1,000 for the gallon of gasoline. Obviously, we're not doing either one. What we are doing is yielding enormous economic benefits from this extremely cheap and versatile energy source. It was inevitable that we would become dependent on this stuff just by its very nature. However, we get to the point where we approach an ecological limit, where actually we find that it's impossible to continue using more of the stuff, and we have to do with what's left. Now, I'm going to talk about a couple of presentations that were made at the ASPO meeting in Lisbon, Portugal, just 2 or 3 weeks ago, which was an extraordinary meeting. And these two presentations, I think, are particularly significant. They do have global significance. The first was a presentation given by Robert L. Hirsch, who was the leader of a project funded by the U.S. Department of Energy. They produced a report called Peaking of World Oil Production, Impacts, Mitigation, and Risk Management. Now, the report was produced by Science Applications International Corporation, which is a company that produces scientific reports for all of the branches of the U.S. government, including the Defense Department. And Robert Hirsch impressed me as being just a straight-ahead, competent engineer. You know, he wore the short-sleeve white dress shirt with a tie and a pocket protector. I don't know how many of you can remember back to the space shots of the 1960s and TV pictures of the computer rooms at NASA and all these engineers with their slide rules and pocket protectors and so on. Well, Robert Hirsch reminded me of, you know, that era. And clearly, the Department of Energy had given SAIC a job to do, which was to examine the question, what happens when global oil production peaks? And what should we be doing about it? The answer that Hirsch and his colleagues came up with, I think, was more than the Department of Energy bargained for. Why do I think that? Because they've virtually buried the report. It's available on the internet on a high school website, not the U.S. Department of Energy website. Let me read you the executive summary of the Hirsch report. It says, "The peaking of world oil production presents the U.S. and the world with an unprecedented risk management problem. As peaking is approached, liquid fuel prices and price volatility will increase dramatically, and without timely mitigation, the economic, social, and political consequences, costs, will be unprecedented. Viable mitigation options exist on both the supply and demand sides, but to have substantial impact, they must be initiated more than a decade in advance of peaking." Let's just unpack some of these conclusions here. First of all, the report makes the point that global oil production peak is inevitable. It's only a question of when. Now, it wasn't the job of Hirsch and his colleagues to try to figure out when global oil production would peak. Simply to see what the consequences would be, and they concluded that the consequences will be serious indeed, and that mitigation efforts have to begin a considerable time before the peak occurs, and they must be undertaken on a crash program scale and speed. Now, they ran three scenarios. First, global oil production peaks 20 years from now, and we begin the crash program immediately. In that case, many of the worst consequences can be mitigated. Second scenario, global oil production peaks 10 years from now, and we begin today with a crash program. Well, as it turns out in their modeling, it takes years for that crash program actually to begin to take hold and have effect. So if global oil production peaks 10 years from now, there will still be very serious impacts from that. Third scenario, we wait until the peak occurs before we try to implement any mitigation strategies. In that case, the consequences are, as the executive summary said, unprecedented in their severity. Now, this demands that we ask the question then, do we have 20 years, first of all? And then are we starting with those full-scale mitigation strategies? Well, do we have 20 years? This was the subject of another presentation at the conference that I thought was extremely important, that of Chris Skrabowski, who is the editor of Petroleum Review in London. First, to set a context for his offering, this slide from the International Energy Agency in London, which is the world's foremost organization for collecting and disseminating energy statistics. And this is from a presentation given last summer at the IEA. And the subject of this slide is oil production capacity. Currently, the world produces and uses something like 83 million barrels of oil per day. But that's not a static figure. According to the IEA, this year, in 2005, we'll need to find and develop an extra 1.5 to 2 million barrels a day to meet new demand, principally from countries like China and, to a lesser extent, India and the United States that are increasing their energy usage, and particularly their oil usage. Then we need another 4 million barrels a day to offset depletion. As I was saying, the global oil industry has been dealing with depletion since the very earliest days. As soon as we begin extracting oil from a given well, it starts depleting. And then if it depletes to the point where its continued production from that well becomes impractical, then we drill another well. Same thing with whole oil fields. We have to go out and find new oil fields to replace the ones that have become depleted. Well, now this is happening on a country-by-country basis. Something like 18 to 20 entire nations have gone past their all-time oil production peaks, as the United States did in 1970. Prior to that time, the U.S. had been the world's foremost oil-producing nation. Now it imports 60% of what it uses virtually. Indonesia, a very important oil exporting nation throughout the 20th century, this year will probably import more oil than it exports. So we see countries jumping from one column to the other, that column of oil exporting nations to the column of oil importing nations. So if this year the U.S. produces less oil than it did in 2004, if Indonesia produces less oil than it did in 2004, as they reliably will, and as 18 other countries will, some other countries have to produce more than they did in 2004 to make up the difference. So according to the IEA, this kind of depletion adds up. Altogether, we'll need about 6 million barrels per day of new production capacity in 2005, again, just to stay even. That's not developing surplus capacity. That's just keeping an even keel. And in 2006, the industry has to do the same thing and a little bit more, 2007, 2008, and this is all cumulative, so that by the time we get to 2010, the industry will have had to have found and developed something like 30 million barrels a day of new production capacity. So can they do it? This is the question that Chris Skrabowski has asked. And it comes up it ends up that it's not a very optimistic picture. While we'll need about 30 million barrels a day by the end of the decade in order to stay even, there are only about 12.5 million barrels a day of new production capacity that are likely to come online. And there are no real surprises in store in this regard, because it takes years to develop a new production project, something like 4 or 5 years for an onshore project and 5 or 6 and even 7 years for an offshore project. So even if we were to find another giant reservoir of 10 billion barrels today, we probably wouldn't be able to bring it into production before the end of the decade anyway. So between now and 2010, we know pretty well what's in store. Clearly, there will not be enough new oil production capacity before the end of the decade to meet demand. And Chris has calculated that the most likely global oil peak date on this basis is 2007. Supplies are likely to remain pretty tight throughout 2005, a bit of relief in 2006, a couple of large production projects coming online there. But by the time we get to 2007, the shortfall will be significant. So here we have on one hand the Hirsch report, which says that we need at least a decade to prepare for global oil production peak. And then we have the Oil Fields Mega Project report from Chris Skrbowski, which says that we may only have months before the actual peak occurs. Now, what if I'm wrong? What if Colin Campbell's wrong? What if Chris Skrbowski is wrong? What if, in fact, we do have 2 decades to prepare? Well, the Hirsch report in that case says that, in fact, even if the optimists are right, then we should be starting to prepare immediately. Now, the implicit argument of the optimists is, well, you know, if global oil production isn't going to peak anytime soon, really, and if we were to start to prepare too soon, we would forego economic growth. We would be investing money and resources and effort into preparing for oil production peak rather than growing our economies and doing all the other sorts of things we like to do. And so, therefore, there would be a cost to preparing too soon. And actually, the Hirsch report addresses this question, and it agrees. It says, yes, there will be a cost to preparing too soon. However, the cost of waiting too long to prepare is far greater than any cost of preparing too soon. So, what are the alternatives to oil? This is a picture of energy usage in the U.S., which isn't that different from most other industrialized nations, oil being the primary energy source there, natural gas number two, and as we've already heard, natural gas is only going to be a help for a short period of time and only in certain places and certain situations. It's not going to be the transition fuel that some theorists like Amory Lovins have suggested, a transition fuel to a hydrogen economy. No, we really can't count on that, because there's limited hydrogen or limited natural gas as well. Coal, enormous amounts of coal in some countries like the United States, South Africa. I was just in South Africa, spoke there to the executives of Sasol Corporation, which has the most advanced coal to liquids technology in the world. And in South Africa, they produce 150,000 barrels a day of synthetic oil from coal. Even in South Africa, where they have this advanced technology, they still import 450,000 barrels of oil per day, mostly from Saudi Arabia and Iran. So even there, where they have enormous high-quality coal reserves, coal to liquids is providing only a partial buffer against the problem of increasing oil prices. How about building more nuclear reactors? Well, certainly that will be done. I'm not among those who welcomes that approach. However, we have to keep in mind that the problem that we're talking about is a shortfall in liquid fuels primarily for transportation. because that's what we use most of the oil for, is for transportation fuel. We have very few electric cars and buses and trucks in the world. So simply building more nuclear reactors is not going to enable us to operate our transportation fleets. And, of course, we have zero electric airliners. How about renewable energy? Of course, we need more energy from renewable sources. And I'm a passionate advocate of renewable energies like wind and solar. In the U.S., and again, this is fairly typical, we're getting about 1% from solar photovoltaics and 2% from wind, but that's not, say, 1% of the total energy budget. That's only 1% of this 6% renewables slice. So it's a very, very tiny proportion of the total energy budget currently coming from renewables. What all of this means in the end is that there is no supply-side solution to this problem of depleting oil. Yes, we do need to pursue supply-side strategies to the extent that we can. We do need to develop renewable energy alternatives. However, we have to do that in the context of the understanding that that cannot be enough to offset the shortfalls of energy from depleting fossil fuels. So the challenges of global peak oil are a lot easier to discuss than the opportunities. Those challenges certainly will be economic. We hear from economists that the world is much less vulnerable to energy price shocks than it was back in the 1970s. After all, we only spend a small portion of every dollar or euro on energy per se, maybe 10 cents on the dollar or 7 cents or something like that. Yes, that's true. But if you look at it systemically, the entire economy is energy dependent. Without energy, nothing happens, by definition. And we know this when the lights go off. If the power goes down, everything grinds to a halt. That's true here in this room, and it's certainly true in an entire industrial nation. So there will be economic consequences. As there is less energy available to do work, less work will be done. There's a little bit of a hedge to that. If we can do the work more efficiently, there's a bit of a hedge, but then efforts toward energy efficiency are subject to diminishing returns over time. In other words, that first 5 or 10 or 20% increment in energy efficiency is cheap, but then as time goes on, increasing increments become much more expensive. Obviously, there will be impacts for transportation, and not only for automobile and truck transportation, but also for the airline industries, places that are dependent for air transport, for tourism, are going to be very profoundly affected, as many others. And, of course, this has implications for urban design. We have been designing our communities, our cities, our towns for the last 50 years on the basis of the automobile. We've been designing for the automobile rather than for human beings. I think of cities in my own country like Phoenix, Arizona, or Los Angeles, or Houston, and try to imagine these places without cheap transportation fuels. And it's hard to come up with any good scenario for how these places could be livable places without cheap transportation fuel. The area of food and agriculture will be profoundly challenged because, of course, we're virtually eating fossil fuels today. Not only are we using giant agricultural machinery, the plows and combines and trucks that transport food to produce more food, but we're also, of course, using fossil fuels in the forms of chemical fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides, and then we are transporting food in larger quantities, further distances. A typical food item on our plates has often come over 2,000 kilometers to get there. And then finally, the problem of war and peace, geopolitics. We human beings have an unfortunate history of fighting over scarce resources. It's not as though we're about to have our first oil war. The 20th century actually featured a number of oil wars, usually under different guises. And certainly the reason for 150,000 American troops being stationed in Iraq right now, I think, has very little to do with bringing democracy to that part of the world. I think it has a great deal to do with the U.S. wanting to establish permanent military bases throughout the region, also in Central Asia, in order to control the flow of oil as we reach the peak and go past it. Now, of course, peak oil is not the only threat facing our species right now. We also have escalating ecological crises, including global climate change, looming public health crises like the Asian bird flu, global economic instability, much of it ensuing from unsupportable levels of U.S. debt, the trade deficit, as well as government debt and consumer debt, and declining global per capita rates of food production. Global food production per capita has already peaked and is in decline now. So are these all completely unrelated problems? I would say actually no. It seems to me that peak oil and all of these problems are in fact very closely related. Why? Because these are all just faces of what I call the universal ecological dilemma of population pressure, resource depletion, and habitat destruction. We've been living with the universal ecological dilemma for as long as we've been a species. Back in Paleolithic times, we hunted megafauna in North America, Australia, Eurasia. We hunted giant mammals to extinction. We have been depleting resources and facing population pressures and using our ingenuity to deal with these problems for tens of thousands of years. What fossil fuels have done is enabled us to ratchet up the universal ecological dilemma to a new scale that was unimaginable before. Always before, whenever we hit up against ecological limits, we had to alter our behavior. There was an immediate feedback mechanism. Fossil fuels gave us a cushion against that feedback mechanism so that if we ran up against depletion of one resource, we could use cheap energy to produce a substitute or to increase the rate of extraction of other available resources. So that 150-year cushion has created unrealistic expectations. It's created economic theories which say that, well, we will never deplete any resource because as soon as one resource starts to deplete, it becomes more expensive and stimulates this availability of substitutes. That kind of theory has worked, actually, over the past 150 years because we've had the cheap fossil fuels to make it work. Without cheap fossil fuels, that economic theory falls to dust. But the point of all of this, the point that these all of these problems are related and that they are related to fossil fuel depletion is that the solution to fossil fuel depletion cannot be simply to find a substitute energy resource. That has to be part of the strategy by which we deal with it, but that cannot be the full solution. We have to look at reducing the size of the human population globally relative to Earth's long-term carrying capacity for human beings. That has to be an essential aspect of our response to this problem. Because how many people can Earth support without cheap fossil fuels? We don't know, but last time we tried, it was only about 1 billion people.